This item was voted on last meeting. Myself and I was present, I was absent, and Councilmember Ashbeck abstained. There's no staff report to be given because this was previously presented. Any discussion by, any member of the public want to address this item? Seeing none, we'll bring it back. Any council discussion? Seeing none, we'll entertain a motion.
I move that we adopt ordinance 19-07.
I'll second it.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
When I abstain?
I'll abstain, yeah.
And I'm also going to abstain because I didn't review the material. So the item passes 3 in favor, 2 abstentions. Item number 8, receive and file housing legislation update and consider policy direction regarding proposed legislation. This is an overarching discussion of law and policy, and this does not apply to any specific project that we're going to be discussing tonight. Staff is Andy Hassler. Andy.
Good evening, Mayor, members of the council. With me tonight, I have Dwight Kroll at my side. We'll be going through a presentation on housing legislation and just kind of the current status of things in relation to. Just for the benefit, so to council, I provided a copy of the presentation. Some of the graphics that we have that are a little easier format to read, and those are available for the public up on this if anyone wants to grab one. And then, Council, I also provided you a League of Cities position sheet for your review as well. So what we're going to be doing tonight is going through a little bit of planning 101, understanding how planning happens and how a project comes to fruition. We'll be looking at current housing affordability in Clovis, how Clovis is doing with housing production, current developments that are going on, previous legislation and their impacts, proposed legislation. I'll give you a brief summary. And then in the end, we'll be seeking direction on any policy positions council wishes to take on legislation. Just of note, no action on a project or land use changes are being considered with this item tonight. So I'm going to turn it over to Dwight for Planning 101, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mayor, members of the City Council. I just want to take you and those in attendance this evening through a little bit of Planning 101. Sometimes the terms are difficult to understand, but I want to try to sort that out a little bit, at least at about a 30,000-foot level. There are a number of things that are involved in planning in our community. They include the general plan, and we're going to talk about that a little bit, the California Environmental Quality Act, master service plans that look at utilities and infrastructure and providing services throughout the community, zoning, which implements the general plan, our development code, of which zoning is a portion of, and the entitlement process. And if you can go to the next one, thank you. So the general plan, a lot of people think of the general plan as just the land use element. There are actually multiple elements to the general plan. They include economic development, circulation, the housing element, public facilities, environmental safety element, open space and conservation, and air quality. However, the land use element is often kind of the driving element of the general plan itself. The general plan is a comprehensive long-term plan, and it's really the blueprint for our community. When I say blueprint, it's the set of plans that are used to guide the principles that have been agreed upon by the community in terms of how they want their community to develop and be in the future. It's also a constitution for development in the community. And when I say constitution, it provides the surety that what's in the general plan will get implemented. To change items in the general plan does take a formal public hearing process, and it's not done in a vacuum. It involves the community. There are very important decisions that are made when amending the general plan, and we take it very seriously. That being said, general plans are required to conform with state and federal laws. And in many cases, these laws do trump our general plan. They're made at another legislative level, whether it's state or federal government. And sometimes we're required then to reorganize our general plan to be able to accommodate those changes in legislation. Let's go to zoning. Zoning is the power that's given to governments to regulate buildings and uses. It implements the general plan, and there's often a lot of confusion about a general plan and zoning. Well, the zoning is kind of the toolbox for actually getting the development done. The general plan says we want this particular land use here. Zoning tells you how it's done. What's the size? What's the height? What's the density? Those types of things are actually described under zoning. It includes a schedule of permitted, permitted by discretion, and prohibited land uses. And so if you go to any particular zone district, it will, those land uses will fall in one of those three categories. And so permitted uses are permitted by right. It might be a single-family zone district where you're allowed to have a single-family home by right. You just come in and you get your building permits, and or you build the house out there. Permitted by discretion falls in a use category such as a conditional use permit, where there's actually a public hearing process involved in considering that application. And an example of that would be a convenience store or a gas station. Does require a use permit to be accomplished. And then the final category are uses that are expressly prohibited in that category. And so there, each zone district has that list of uses that you cannot do in that zone district. And there's probably other ways of looking at it. You're finding another zone district where it's consistent, or maybe doing a zone change or a general plan change. Entitlements, if we can go to that one, ensure the, projects are consistent with the general plan, with zoning, with applicable laws, that being state and federal laws, and are approved in the appropriately prescribed manner. And that's a little bit of planning 101. So when we do entitlements, sometimes state and federal laws prescribe how those entitlements can occur, whether it requires a public participation or precludes public participation, whether it's discretionary or ministerial. And that is reflected in the zoning that occurs there. The entitlement process is really where you get down to what that project's going to look like, what the color of it is, how it sits on the site and whatnot. So you're going to hear a little bit of discussion later on with Andy here about some of the state regulations that are coming our direction. We have some currently that we're trying to address. There are a large number of them on the horizon that we'll have to be looking into. Some of them are just kind of getting started, and some may be wrapping up. And so these may require doing some general plan work. It may require doing some zoning work. And it also may preclude some public participation or the or discretionary action in actually allowing or not allowing those projects. So I'll stop at that point and turn it back over to Andy.
So, and if there's any questions along the way, feel free to ask. I'd like this to be as interactive as possible if something comes up. So affordable housing has really been the impetus, one, for this presentation, but also what is going on in the state legislature. And this chart gives you an idea of why. So this is from the California Association of Realtors, and it's a graphic they put together on a quarterly basis showing what percentage of households in any given county can actually afford to purchase a median priced home. The red bar is the state of California, and on average, 28% of households can afford a single family median priced home. And it goes down from there for many of the most populous counties, including all of the Bay Area, to as low as 12%, which is Santa Cruz County. So this is the crux of the affordability crisis, is that too few families can afford to purchase a home in the state of California. For reference point, the city of Clovis is in Fresno County, obviously, and it's marked in that black box. And that puts us at about 46% of households. So we're doing markedly better than many of our coastal neighbors, but it is still an issue. Just some stats for you on Clovis. The current median home value is $324,000 in Clovis. This has risen about $50,000 over the last 3 years. $324,000. Bye. The current median rental price in Clovis is $1,140. And currently, the city has 831 units of deed-restricted affordable housing. And that's important to note. There's a difference between sometimes what's covered in the media as affordable or the state legislature and what a lot of people consider to be affordable. Deed-restricted affordable housing is when a property owner has committed to charge a less-than-market rent, and generally there's some type of investment that has occurred or a subsidy that has occurred to require that over a significant period of time, generally 55 years, whether it's a for purchase or for a rental property. Much of legislation and discussion has been more about density in relation to affordable housing as of late. And so there's some nuances there that we'll walk through during some of this legislation. But let me go to one more slide. I think we'll get there, or two. So Clovis's affordability has been well documented. The San Francisco Chronicle cited Clovis as being the second most affordable housing market with a significant population in the state, only behind Visalia. And we've been making some pretty great strides with our cottage home program. This program has been recognized nationally and has been really a template for other cities in California and elsewhere to make a second dwelling unit program work. And we're seeing several units being developed and a lot of great press coverage on that. And that's adding housing stock. It's not necessarily affordable or subsidized, but it's adding housing stock that hopefully be a lower rent rate than typical because it's being added to. In addition to that, we have been partnering with self-help enterprises to offer a low-income family the ability to do one of these if they own a piece of property where they could do one. So housing production. This chart is from the Los Angeles Times, and it shows housing production since the late 80s in California. The State Department of Housing and Community Development has determined that we need 180,000 units of housing to be produced per year in California to keep up with population growth. And we have been far short of that. I think just recently, the state for 2018, which isn't on this chart, stated that we hit 80,000 units or 60,000 units. I read it this morning. So, as a state, we are not performing well. And if you look at this, this closely tracks economic cycles. But we have been woefully underproducing, which gets back to the affordability issues that were on the chart previous. So how are we doing in Clovis? Our chart, albeit it doesn't go back to 1990, mirrors the economic cycles that the state has been experiencing overall. But with that, Clovis has been outproducing itself over the last few years especially. Clovis is the second fastest growing city in the state of California with populations of over 100,000. We are only growing slower than the city of Chico. The city of Chico grew significantly because, unfortunately, the Paradise transplants have come into Chico. We are adding a significant portion of the rooftops as well, not just population, where we're doing at least 1%, maybe more, of the housing production in the whole entire state right now. So we're seeing a lot of production going on in Clovis. Things are being done well to encourage that production. So this is where we'll get to the affordability versus density numbers. So this chart was actually presented to council about a month ago. It was part of the Housing Element Annual Report. This chart shows both our goals that we report to the state and the number of units we actually produced by income category. Part of the housing element, which is a portion of the general plan that Dwight described, requires a city to plan for a certain number of units. And for the city of Clovis, for this cycle, it was 6,328 units. Those units are then broken down by the state into what they call income categories. Very low, low, moderate, and above moderate. And there's a number assigned for each there. Those are then correlated to density. We have to plan for, in our general plan, a density to accommodate that number of units in order to meet state housing law. When we go to report to the state, than the actual production of units. We report on the number of units that are actually affordable, as in what you and I would consider affordable, not necessarily if it was dense or if it was on a very large lot. It's what is affordable to that family. So in Clovis, we have been underproducing on very low and low actual affordable units. Very little subsidy has been occurring. There's several reasons for that. And not as much density, but we've been producing quite a bit more moderate and above moderate. In most other communities, you're seeing almost all above moderate units being produced.
So this might be a good time for my question.
Yes.
So when they are calculating the RENA numbers here that are displayed, we are looking at actual density, how many homes per acre. But when we report out, if I understood you correctly, we're not talking about density. We're talking about affordability as you and I think of affordability?
Correct. So let's say, for an example, a very dense project came in and was built, like we have some going on right now, but they were market rate. On this chart, they would be in the moderate or above moderate categories.
Okay. So the analogy that I often give is I try to explain the issue of affordability from the RENA numbers perspective, at least when we're putting them together. We'll talk about the Millennial Tower in San Francisco, extremely dense structure. And so in RENA numbers perspective, would that be considered to be affordable housing, or at least when it comes to this chart?
For planning purposes, it would, the land being zoned that dense would be meet your RENA need.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
For planning purposes, for meeting your RENA allocation, regional housing need allocation number for very dense housing, it would be counted toward that. But reporting to the state your actual production, it would most likely be in the very high category.
Okay. So for the for RENA numbers, at least as far as planning is concerned, it does it is considered to be affordable, even though they're $3 million apartments. But in actuality, the analogy starts to fall apart when there is an actual reporting to the state and saying how much has been affordable. We say, well, San Francisco would report that that is actually not affordable. It's just happens to meet this density.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I had a question on that also, Mayor. What the state holds us to is just the RENA numbers and the zoning that will accommodate those RENA numbers, correct?
That's correct.
And then whether we build very low, low, or moderate, there's no time restriction on that. It's based on the market because we can zone it all, but if no one builds, we may have zero units potentially. So they're not holding us to where you have 2,321. This is during the 2000 whatever 13 RENA cycle. Why haven't you built any low? Currently, there's no mandate by the state for us on that end, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Is that
our current legislation, current law? That's correct.
So the only obligation of the jurisdiction is to provide the zoning by which potentially this type of housing can be built?
Yes.
Okay.
So the city has made a lot of efforts in the affordable housing area. We have a down payment assistance program, housing rehab programs where we've invested a lot of funds, and development assistance where we offer assistance to developers to develop, I'll say, truly affordable or subsidized affordable housing. This program has survived despite being facing significant cuts during the redevelopment days. We have seen basically our major backbone resource of funding go away. And through grants and pursuing creativity of staff, we've been able to hold together and focus on things to help families out. But the large money coming in to do big projects has, for all intents and purposes, dried up. So, but recently, with the state starting to issue more and more RFPs with state funding for projects, we're seeing more and more interest in the development side with people interested in doing projects. The current revenues we have available, our community development block grant, that's a federal source of funding, and we pretty much put all that money into housing rehabilitation. We get very little funds to do that, so we're focused on taking care of the housing stock that we have, keeping it safe and affordable for our low-income residents. We also pursue state housing funds, some of which are also federal, for down payment assistance. We just received a $1 million grant to do a down payment assistance program for this coming year. And then state housing funds also can be applied for development projects, and we'll assist development developers in doing that. And then we do have a small amount of money left over from our housing successor agency. We're really looking to see what to do with that in regards to some of the new funding sources that are coming online and how best to leverage that going forward.
Question, Andy. I recall when we were, our RENA was not in compliance, we had a risk of losing state funds. So is it just that second bullet? It was like two million, something like that, that we potentially were in jeopardy of losing?
There was the inability to apply for state housing funding, what was immediate risk. That was the down payment assistance program and other related programs to that. So probably $1 million to $2 million.
Okay. Thanks.
So currently we have what I broke down into RENA projects versus deed control projects. And Dwight may be able to fill in the details a little bit if you have any questions. But underway right now, we have some Loma Vista multifamily projects going on. We have 295 units going in that meet the RENA density, their market rate. We also have some units going in south of Sierra Vista Mall that will also meet the densities in the RENA for affordable housing at 216 units. We have some deed control projects. Magnolia Crossing was completed just a little over a year ago now. That was a senior supportive housing project. 48 units, 24 of those were affordable. And then Habitat for Humanity is building single-family homes in the Stanford Addition in Rialto Rancho, and those are guaranteed affordable for a set period of time. We also have some projects coming. There's a project at Herndon and McKelvey. That project has 158 units. And then we have some deed control projects that are on the horizon. The Fresno Housing Authority has a project. There's an image of that on the bottom. Habitat for Humanity is working on a few more homes. And we've had a lot of interest in permanent supportive housing projects coming to us.
Question. Just to clarify, when you say, like back at the top, Loma Vista multifamily, 295 units, that's not the total units under construction. That is the number of units that qualify in the RENA calculation.
That is one particular project that is meets the density requirements for RENA.
Meets the density requirement. So that's the entire development counts. Okay. Thanks.
Correct. And then I had a question related to some of these projects. Now I know that this is just illustrative of the types of projects that you've been describing. You've mentioned that the one on the bottom is the project that is coming into the city of Clovis via the Fresno Housing Authority. Is this the one that is at Alluvial and Willow?
Yes.
Okay. And then the one that's up there?
That's the Loma Vista project that Wilson Development is doing.
That's going to be right next to the park that we have?
Yes.
There. All right.
Just north of the high school.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So in 2017, there was also a big push to address some of the state's housing issues. This issue has been around for a while. And 13 bills were passed. It really did three major things, that package of bills. It provided critical funding for new affordable homes through a state bond and a recording fee, also known as SB2. It accelerated development to increase housing supply. Streamlined processes were put in place. And then it held cities and counties accountable for addressing housing needs in their communities. And that really was the RENA issue. So how did this play out over the last few years? Well, the city of Huntington Beach got sued through that accountability. And Clovis, we were pressed to get our RENA in compliance, get our rezone program in place. We were able to do that and got recertified with our housing element about a month ago. And then the State Department of Housing and Community Development issued an RFP, or a NOFA, I'm sorry, for the planning grants through SB2 funding. And this money is meant for cities to come in, look at retooling their general plans or any other work. And we're looking at a few things that would allow for housing to be streamlined in the entire state. SB2 funding will be coming forward in the future as a formula allocation to cities for affordable housing purposes. The details on that aren't real clear yet. We're not sure on the amount that we're going to be getting, but it's something that's starting to be developed, and is being paid for as you record documents at the county official records, $75 per document. Also, over the last few years, the Bay Area started getting really serious on dealing with their housing issues. The Bay Area, you know, over a period of time, added a significant number of jobs, 400,000, 500,000 jobs, and only 60,000 units of housing. And that's why they are in the position they are in, that they cannot house the people that they have jobs for. So they got together. It was led by their Council of Governments and their Transportation Commission to form what's called the CASA Compact. And the CASA Compact printed a document with their strategy in January of 19. It was really all rolled out in late 18. And the reason why I bring it up, and I've read it thoroughly, is because a lot of the legislation that is coming forward now is based on the CASA Compact. They have some great ideas to address their housing issues, but mind you, this is about a 9-county area that is driving a lot of the legislation that's coming through and being considered in Sacramento right now. So that's by way of just kind of background, how we got where we're at.
Andy, I've got one more question for you.
Yes.
Sorry. I think that the point that you made related to the Bay Area and how many new jobs, 400,000, 500,000, and then how many homes have been built during that same period of time mm-hmm. in the Bay Area really does point out the what California considers to be the crises. When it comes to the city of Clovis, do you have any numbers that might help us make some type of comparison as to how many jobs we've created versus how many new homes have been coming in over that same time period or yeah. a time period?
So bear with me here.
Sure.
This is bad screen etiquette. But so back in 2012 to now, 2012-13, during that same time period, we have added about 8,000 jobs
okay.
in Clovis. Now, mind you, our unemployment rate was significantly under, so we probably had residents that did not have employment at that time compared to the Bay Area.
Okay, understood.
But looking at that, so we're at 500, 1,300, 2,000, 27, 36, 46, and then through this year. So we've about 5,000 units were added just to Clovis alone.
And give me the jobs number again.
About 8,000.
8,000. So we are underperforming, at least not meeting the amount of jobs that are coming
yeah.
in as far as housing is concerned if we were considering having one new house for every new job created.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, so I found this graphic that was helpful for me in just kind of getting the lay of the land on what's being proposed in Sacramento. This is legislation that has been proposed, and it's not everything. There's over 2,000 bills that were presented to the legislature. This is a League of California Cities summary, double-sided, both sides. Staff has read through, i.e. me, every bill. And we've really tried to boil down the discussion for tonight to items that were of interest to the city. There are quite a few items on this graphic that we won't be talking about this evening. But it does give you an idea of everything that's being looked at by the state legislature, everything from rent control issues, tax policy, legal aid, funding, ballot measure policy, that is really they're trying to wrap their hands around everything. And a lot of this is, one, coming from the CASA Compact, as well as from the governor's request to really tackle affordable housing when he was brought into office. So the first bill we're going to look at is SB 50. This one has probably gotten the most press. SB 50, it's gone through quite a bit of gyrations over the last month or so and was recently combined with Senate Bill 4. And it has gained a lot of traction. It has gotten out of the policy committees and is now being heard in the Appropriations Committee. Next step after that is to hit the Senate floor. And SB 50 is really a bill, if I summarized it, to eliminate density requirements, which are laid out in our general plan, in near high-quality transit stops or train stations, which we'll get to some of these definitions, and job-rich areas. Much of the focus on the media has been this bill is for places that are next to a high-quality transit stop or a ferry terminal or the Transbay terminal in San Francisco, for instance. But what the language does include is this term called job-rich areas. And here's how this would work. So a job-rich area means an area is identified by the Department of Housing and Community Development that is, one, a high opportunity. It means it either has more jobs than is typical for the tract, or it has reduced commutes to high-quality jobs, or it has access to high-quality schools. So you take that, you take off the transit portion, which Clovis does not have any transit bus stops that meet the definition in the bill currently, and much of our city could potentially be considered to be qualified underneath this terminology. So what does that mean in reality for Clovis? Much of our city, based on this language being used in other bills and past practice by the Department of Housing and Community Development, is considered to be what's called high quality. And that speaks volumes for what this community has done for building a high quality, great place to live. This chart right here comes from the California State Tax Credit Allocation Committee. They have determined to determine, they provide points in their system for affordable housing based on how high a quality and how many amenities a neighborhood has. And you get more points, which is great. You want us neighborhoods, people having access to these things. We suspect that this will be some of the same charting mapping methodology that's being used in by HCD going forward in determining these high quality areas where these projects would be required. So if we had a single family tract of land and it was in one of these areas, a developer by right could come in and there would be no density limitations at all. There would be a reduction in parking requirements down to a half stall per unit. And they would be able to do this by right, or as Dwight put it, without any kind of due process. So it's concerning to us in that much of our general plan has been thought through well. It has been a document that has been bought into by the community. And it is something that we have planned for, both for our infrastructure and for our community service needs. And seeing this level of intensity being allowed in any residential zone district in the city could throw a lot of our general plan out the window, per se. They would have to, if they exercise this, they would have to include so many units at different levels of the size of project as being truly affordable, not just density affordable. And then they also exempted coastal areas under 50,000 in population and rural counties and areas that are near fire-prone, high-risk areas. Also in this bill, if you are not in one of these high-quality areas or near a transit stop, you would be allowed by right to do a duplex or a quadplex in a single-family area. And that was where the bill was amended relatively recently to combine SB 4 with SB 50. No, populations, the county have to be underneath 600,000 in population. So we can get into this bill a little bit more. I provided a step-by-step graphic up there, which is not the next slide, but I have it available. There's also a graphic here that kind of walks you through where you're at relative to this bill. Because it is a very complicated piece of legislation. And I'll just kind of preface everything I say with things change rapidly. It's been fascinating to see how fast things change in Sacramento on the language and bills. Just this morning, I was having to change significantly this presentation from what I had on last Thursday because of changes to bill language. So we'll see where it goes.
And will you tell us, like, what's the status of the bill at this
point? It is being heard in the Appropriations Committee. It passed out of the policy committees in the Senate. So the Appropriation Committee, from my understanding, would then hear it, and then it would go to the Senate floor for a vote. Then it would have to make its way through the Assembly. It is on the League's list of opposed without amendments. Yeah. So at the end of this presentation, I have a slide with our recommendations on oppose or support legislation.
Andy, initially you said something about affordability. When these things get built, the affordability will be determined by whom? And any idea what affordable would be?
As an affordable housing practitioner, that's one of the major questions I have, just aside from the land use policy questions. So if a project is 21 to 200 units, essentially 15% or so of the units would have to be truly affordable or rent deed restricted affordable. There's no mechanism in the bill for who actually enforces that. I would assume it would be the city staff having to do that, but it's not clearly spelled out. All right, moving on. SB 330. This bill is in the same position as SB 50 as far as position in the legislature. It has made it out of the policy committee and is now in the appropriations committee. SB 330 would, until 2030, prohibit a city where average rent exceeds 130% of the national median rent do the following. And I'll get to our position on those numbers shortly. You would not be able to downzone property. That means taking a property that is zoned for apartments and take it to townhomes or single family or large lot single family to small lot single family. You cannot pose any parking requirements. You cannot increase development impact fees until 2030. You cannot add any fees for affordable housing projects, such as an inclusionary zoning policy. I can get into that if anyone's interested. You cannot impose more expensive design standards, which is not well defined. You cannot limit the number of CUPs issued. Clovis doesn't have that, but some communities do. And it would disallow any growth management policies that cities may have. The League has taken an opposed position on this bill. So this bill would only be triggered if our rent in Clovis, based on American Community Survey data, exceeded by 30% the national median rent. So 130% of national median rent right now is $1,276. Clovis's average is $1,140 per that data set. So we're not far. You're just considering how where the nation goes and where our rents go, we could be in this position. SB 1763, this would require the city's density bonus law to provide an 80% density bonus. Currently is 35%. Under state law, we have to have a density bonus ordinance. This law allows for densities to be increased on projects if a developer agrees to provide them some units at an affordable price as a deed restricted unit. This would change that to 80%, they could go up to 80% more. It also limits our ability to how many bonuses could be provided. So when you're implementing density bonus law, not only do you get an increased number of units on a piece of property per state law, but you also see reduced parking requirements or setbacks or building heights can be increased, kind of development standards. But right now, our law is compliant, but this would require it to go up to 80%. Some awareness.
Andy, so this proposed bill allows it. Is there other bills that then will finance it or for the developer? Because for them to have a title restriction, I mean, there has to be an incentive. They have to incentivize this. Are they going to incentivize it too?
Yeah, there's a few bills regarding financing I have highlighted toward the end here. Accessory dwelling units. Yeah, there's several bills regarding these, and Clovis is ahead of the curve, as I mentioned before, on ADUs or the cottage home program that Dwight and his team have done so well on. One of the highlights on this is that one of the bills would actually allow us to count ADUs toward our RENA numbers. So in the past, if a property is developed with a single family home, we couldn't count another unit potentially going there as toward our RENA obligation. So that could be helpful in accommodating future need. going forward. But a lot of these bills have caused some concern because they take away local control on how ADUs are implemented. They take away the ability to charge fees. They take away the ability to regulate setbacks and parking requirements and those types of things. So there's a lot of concern in general from a lot of cities, and the League has taken an opposed position on these bills as well. The impact to us probably isn't as significant because our cottage home program has been so well thought through and implemented that it wouldn't be a significant impact because our program works. But there is some concern there.
But Andy, to be clear, accessory dwellings already exist in clubs or can exist law,
yes.
Right? But this is going to facilitate it even more.
Yeah, and this would reduce any kind of standards the city may impose.
So property owner can already do it, and it's actually bigger than our cottage houses if they use the law, but this will facilitate it even more.
Yes.
Okay.
SB 48, this bill would allow supportive housing in all residential zone districts by right and removes any parking requirements. This bill also would allow for supportive housing to be in non-residential zoning districts if certain findings are made by the jurisdiction as them being appropriate and having appropriate amenities nearby. The League does not have a position on this bill. And right now it is also in the Appropriations Committee out of policy.
Andy, so what? In this bill, if we have an underutilized commercial area, they could, by right, go in and put a shelter of some type in there?
Yes.
Any zone district.
Any zone district. The bill calls out residential for sure, and it gives some caveats for non-residential zone districts. Basically, you can't put one in an area that doesn't have services.
Okay.
By right.
Services like utilities or services like
Social services, access to grocery stores, pharmacy, those kinds of things is how I read it. SB 1568, so this would tie the city's progress toward housing production goals with the distribution of transportation funding, SB 1. So this is where if the city didn't actually produce lower income housing, that we would lose transportation funding. It's been talked about quite a bit in the media. This bill has been placed in the suspense file and is no longer active. I just wanted to update you on that. The League has taken an opposed position on this. So now on to the funding. There's several bills on funding, but the League supports two. Assembly Bill 10, it provides state tax credits for affordable housing in addition to. It's an extra $500 million. The tax credit program has proven to be a good tool for supporting affordable housing, and the industry uses it well, both federal and state level. And then SB 5 is a redevelopment-style funding mechanism that may provide up to $2 billion a year statewide to fund affordable housing, which is getting back to some of the resources the city used to have. Clarity on how that would be rolled out is still in the details in the bill, and we're tracking that closely. So when you combine the reduction in the discretion that a city has with some of these bills and past legislation that's passed, plus the additional funding that's coming along line now from past legislation, and potentially this, there's quite a bit of pipeline being created where we're going to see demand for projects that we may not have seen over the last five, 10 years. So a quick summary here. Past legislation has decreased the city's ability to have discretion on housing projects, increased penalties for failing to comply, closed its plan for the number of units required by the state, and increased funding is available for affordable housing projects. CLOAS is housing production to market. CLOAS has produced a significant number of new units. Most of the units are affordable to moderate and higher income families. CLOAS is affordable, more affordable than much of California. And there's an interest in a range of affordable housing projects growing due to the increased funding from the state. Proposed legislation further reduces city's discretion on approving affordable housing projects and increases funding available to subsidize affordable housing. We're seeking some direction tonight on any policy positions the council would like to take. We have some recommended positions. Assembly Bill 10 is a state tax credit funding, and SB 5 is a redevelopment style funding that we would recommend to support. And opposed is AB 1763, which reduces our land use controls, SB 48, which is the supportive housing in any district, SB 50, which is the elimination of densities, and SB 330, which is kind of a catch-all, fees and discretion going away. That concludes my presentation. I'm available to answer any questions on any of the legislation. If there's legislation that you did not see me highlight, I can do my best at answering those questions as well.
Any questions for staff?
Jose? Going back on the funding, SB 5 sounds good, but the minute we start a new redevelopment agency and we get involved again in affordable housing and being developers ourselves, then prevailing wage is triggered and cost per unit goes up because now the city's involved in the law, other laws trigger, mm-hmm. and now that unit is more expensive just because we got involved. So are we going to be able to, how did it work before and will it work better in the future? And are they doing something about prevailing wage? So, you know, they give us an incentive, but they take it away with prevailing wage.
So prevailing wage is required under federal and state law for any kind of public investment. There are some exceptions for affordable housing, but mostly on projects that are a much smaller number of units. So in what the state's wanting to see, that's most likely not an exception that would be provided. All the legislation I've seen reinforces prevailing wage being required. In the past, we've been able to work around this, but it does increase the level of subsidy a developer needs to make a project truly affordable. But that is something that through the revenue streams you're able to mitigate, but the cost per unit is significant, at least in this area, because our rent, our labor is generally quite a bit cheaper than prevailing wages compared to where those wages are set from the Bay Area.
So we can get an apartment unit like Fresno's where it's $500,000 for a tiny apartment. We can go buy a big old house with that same amount of money.
Yeah, it's not untypical to see affordable housing projects in the Valley in the $450,000 per unit range for multifamily, when if they're subsidized and have all these layers of requirements and multiple funding streams adding additional requirements that increase the cost of the project. It's not just prevailing wage. There's other things such as meeting energy standards above and beyond the building code and other things.
So we would meet our density requirements but not our affordability requirements in that scenario?
So the units would cost that much, but if you provided that kind of investment from a public entity, they would have to be reduced rent. So the investment is essentially buying down the rent for the future occupants. So they would qualify to meet on that report that we produce that number of units, even though they cost a significant amount.
Any other questions for staff?
Yeah, I want to be clear that the recommendations from staff are consistent with the recommendations from the League of California Cities.
They are.
Thank you.
With the exception of SB 48, the League has not taken a position on that.
Just so should we do more than I guess some of these I think are incredibly worrisome, and I think those in the here tonight will be 50 people that will know about this and 115,000 that won't know. I mean, the impact on the city of Clovis is really dramatic if these were to pass, I think. I kind of used to joke that maybe in 10 years you won't need any local government at all, at least not us or Planning Commission, because it'll all be allowed, and that may be where this is going. But is there something we should do as a city that's more aggressive? I know our elected officials at the state level are predominantly Republican, so their voice is tiny up there. But is there something more that you recommend we do, like put everyone in this room in a bus and drive to Sacramento? Or I'm not sure, but I mean, is there something more than just an opposed letter or just a question, I guess?
So as with any democracy, the voice of the people needs to be heard. And
people?
And our legislature needs to hear people's opinions on legislation, you know, for better or for worse. So anything we can do to encourage that conversation to occur at that level, I would support.
That's a good comment, Andy. Thank you.
Any other questions for staff?
Yeah. I wanted to see, kind of follow what Lynn just said with regards to our city. I think we rely so much on just the league. You know, here's what they say, we go with them, we don't go with them. But internally, do we need to invest in someone who actually follows this closer, who represents our interests, our citizens' interests, so that way when the meat gets put on these bones, we get to say, this is how we're going to define that. This is how, because that's where a lot of the work gets done. I mean, this stuff gets passed, it goes to some department, and they define everything. And many times it's, you know, groups in the community who go up there and they say, you know, you need to add this, you need to add that. And I'm not saying that it may or may not be our legislatures, but it also may be us or who we need to connect with to be active in that role. And I think it may be a worthy investment, unless we just go, you know, moving forward, if we have less authority, that's fine too. But I think that we want to maintain some sort of authority, some sort of autonomy, some sort of sense of where this is Clovis. And so that's something for us to think about, Luke, as we see more and more this type of legislation moving down. And not whether it's for or against, but so that we have a voice and that we can trust going up. Because sometimes the league takes positions where I think we don't agree with. And so that's why I like them, but not all the time.
Right, and we don't just follow the league's lead, like in this situation of these six bills up there. You know, one, we're recommending a position that the league hasn't taken. We're recommending opposition when the league hasn't taken a position on it. Andy's done a good job. As he said at the beginning, there's, I think, 2,000 housing bills at some stage or another in Sacramento. In the past, we have hired consultants to work with us on other topics. Not necessarily able to draw a direct line between our investment and the return on that in the past. So what we've done so far on this is try to monitor the ones that are kind of bubbling to the top. There's 2,000. Most of them won't see the light of day, hopefully. But we will keep an eye on the ones that are moving through, and this is our initial round of recommendations. We'll keep an eye on the others, and certainly if other problematic bills come forward and start to look like they're gaining traction, we will be bringing back a recommendation for opposition. At a certain point, you know, we're writing a letter. How much letter, you know, how much weight does that carry? We're not driving this discussion. The Central Valley is not driving this discussion. Unfortunately, you know, the state does have a housing crisis, and there's a number of causes for that. But the state is having to adopt measures that kind of a one-size-fits-all and apply them statewide, because they just don't have the staff power to, you know, develop a different plan for all 450 different cities in the state. So we're caught up in it. We can argue against it. I don't know that hiring a consultant would do us much better than that.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I support the league because one thing, regardless of political ideologies, one thing the California League of Cities does and their mantra is local control. Local control. And if we can get all the cities of this state to keep fighting for that local control, and these bills show that the state of California wants to take our control from the local residents, this is a great fight for the league. It's many voices. It's all of every city in California. But then we have to partner with the counties, because what affects us will affect the counties that we belong to. And also the other advocates that we have up there in Sacramento, and law enforcement, the fire teachers, it's going to affect everybody. So they plan to live in a certain kind of community, but now Sacramento is saying you can't. We'll decide what kind of community you live in. So I think we can find partners out there that would advocate for us. And it's not just a paid consultant or some kind of lobbyist that works for us, but those other agencies of people that will be hurt by all this legislation.
I was just gonna, I mean, over the years, we don't see much of our assembly people and our senators here. I mean, maybe it's specific outreach locally to those folks as a city. I'm not exactly sure, but if we send the letter off to the committee, which is important, and everyone sends a letter, that's one thing. But I think keeping our delegation is primarily Republican, so not their voices not as well heard, I suppose. I think just engaging them and having constituents call them and say, this isn't okay, I think is really important. But I just don't know that, I haven't seen those state elected officials here in a long time. We probably haven't invited them, but I think it's important to reach out to them and let them know the impact of the places in their communities. Because maybe it's not that hard to kind of carve out this county or that county, but right now, if proximity to good schools and SB 50 passes, and that will have a dramatic effect on the city of Corpus. So I just think we need to do a little maybe local outreach to our own elected officials, potentially. And we can do that. We could help you or do it or whatever, but I think we could do that as well.
Any other questions for staff? Okay, we'll open this up to the public. Any member of the public who would like to address their council on this item, please come to the podium. Surprising. Oh, yes, sir. Come on down. And if you would state your name and address for the record, please.
My name is Mark Langowski, 2989 Powers Avenue, Clovis, California. Mr. Mayor, City Council members, thank you for this opportunity. I think I echo what you're feeling in terms of involvement, and I think there's people here that are, as myself, number one, I came here to get educated to a great extent. I think Andy's done a great job, and I think we're all looking for more information on how we can actually address this as a total community. And you know, there's got to be methodologies and channels open to us, the public, to somehow get involved or add additional support to the council members so that we can adopt this and attack it in an intelligent form. So I think today was at least from my perspective, you know, just scratching the surface from an educational standpoint, and I understand the burden that you guys are going to be all involved in as time goes by. I'd be interested in seeing some of the additional information that was presented here as, you know, public information, so we could see the presentation, kind of mull over it, and, you know, continue to further educate ourselves. And I think lastly, you know, you mentioned the 50 people versus the other 115,000 that are not here. You know, how do we get those up to 5,000 or 10,000? I mean, I don't think we're going to get all 115,000, but there's got to be some availability of a communication channel via social media, press, et cetera, or just continuation of outreach programs, so that we have a conduit in order to, one, get further educated and become very informed. Because there was a saying I used to use in the businesses that I was involved in the absence of information, people will create it, and it's usually wrong. So hopefully we can get further involved, get more information on this pressing matter that we see in front of us, and, you know, truly a good job here, because just opened my eyes as to what's actually going on, and also understanding that it's not really the city of Clovis that's you know, trying to make these changes. You could kind of have a gun being held to your head, and you, as the mayor is going, yes. So that's a better understanding just in of itself, that, you know, it's you guys are having to respond to what the state is actually doing. So hopefully we can, you know, come to terms, you can get some more outreach, get more people involved, maybe have a few more of these sessions. I don't know if that's beneficial, but somehow just get us involved and get us more information so we can ask more questions and become more informed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wangowski. I think it's a good point. If we could put this presentation on our website with a voiceover, I think that would be helpful for people who are at home tonight with their kids. I think that would be very helpful. Anyone else in the public wish to address their council on this item? Okay, seeing none, I will close public comments and come back to the council. This is a read and advise item, so we won't be taking any action.
We did request some...
I'm sorry?
Some policy direction is requested.
Oh, that's right.
If I may?
Yes.
Thank you. I want to kind of put this in context. I think we all have our own personal experiences associated with our upbringing and those who have come before us. So I often talk about my mother and how it is that she was raised in the city of Clovis and how people used to look down on the city of Clovis as being a bunch of, frankly, she said, ditch bank Okies. And a lot of us are folks that have come here from different parts of the state, different parts of our nation, different parts of the world, and have found really a little piece of opportunity in the city of Clovis. That opportunity has come about as a result of the citizens choosing to improve themselves. And we had leaders that came long before the five of us here, and not just with this organization, the council, but also with the school board, who figure out a way to improve their lot. And as a result of those decisions that were made in the past, the city of Clovis really has become a shining star of opportunity for those who wish to gaze upon us. I want to make sure that as we go through this process that we are not reactionary. I want to make sure that we are responding with some thought, because what I don't want to have happen is for us to forget our roots, that those who have come before us have been in a bad spot economically. And we want to make sure that we don't become like those who look down on the city of Clovis, but we come to look like those who came before us in leadership positions and made sure that we did provide opportunity for those folks who wish to have a better living as a result of their hard work and their principles and their values. So I want to first state the context of at least my viewpoint on some of these things that are happening from my perspective. Also, I think that it's not uncommon for those involved in larger venues like up in Sacramento or at the federal level to not be responsive, not be thoughtful in their approach to how to address an issue, but to be reactionary. And a lot of the legislation that we're seeing is a result of a reactionary approach to addressing what was and has been an issue identified in the Bay Area that I think Andy did a great job. And I also want to take an aside and say this has been a great presentation. And I do hope that we get the PowerPoint with the voiceover is a really good idea, so that one, we can explain not just to our citizens but those who I think are struggling with this issue statewide how it's going to be impacting not just the city of Clovis but others. So anyway, the it's not uncommon for people to be a reactionary, as we're seeing up in Sacramento, and I think it's really important for those reasons, really, that we continue to approach this from a local control argument, not any other approach. The city of Clovis has shown us ourselves to be responsible in providing opportunity for those who wish to have opportunity by providing a great educational system, by providing good jobs to those people who wish to have good jobs. So. And I also kind of want to point out this aside. I think that when it comes to affordable housing, boy, it takes a lot of different it creates a picture in a lot of people's minds which is not necessarily consistent with reality. So when I look at affordable housing and I see Magnolia Crossing, I think this is a beautiful place. This is an opportunity for me to be able to put my parents or my in-laws in a place where they're going to have community with folks who have kind of grown up and reached that point where they need to be more well taken care of than what they're receiving in their own home or I can provide for them as a son or a son-in-law. I see places where we've had Habitat for Humanity come in and people who have engaged in sweat equity in order to build a home for their families as well. So those are really great places in the city of Clovis that I think all of us in the community would say, yeah, we want those types of places in our home. My mother-in-law happened to, at part of her life, grow up in some projects in Buffalo, New York. During the last reunion, we went there, and the projects still exist. Many of the windows are busted out, and there is now wood over them. You can see drug deals taking place midday in some of these projects. So that's another picture that some people have. And then what I hope we're starting to see in our mind is a picture of what the Fresno Housing Authority has started to put together in the city of Fresno. And also I think with what we're seeing is the elevation that's at Alluvial and Willow Avenue. Government housing is not my mother-in-law's government housing. Government housing today is a lot different picture than what we may have. So I want you to be open to the idea that government housing can be done right. And if you look at what the Fresno Housing Authority has done close to the Veterans Hospital, just drive on by there, you would not think it's affordable housing. Those are apartment complexes that you would want to live in yourself. So I guess I'm trying to communicate that let's not be reactionary. Let's be thoughtful and responsive as we try to work with those who are trying to push this agenda really down the throats of local communities and make sure that we're not coming across as people who are presenting poorly. And it's not a good reflection of the city of Clovis because, frankly, our heritage is such that we have done a great job in the city of Clovis in providing opportunity for people to improve their social mobility from generation to generation. So let's make sure that we communicate that message as a whole. Thank you, Mayor.
I just would say, did I sound reactionary? I can. To me, I think and you said it, I think it's about local control. It's not about anything else at all. It's just Clovis has gotten to where we are because of the folks that came before us and because of the thoughtful planning. And there is much in this legislation that puts all that at risk. So if you have a vacant lot next to your house and some of these things pass, the very principles of local control and the neighborhoods we love will be gone, and we will have nothing to do with it. So I think it's not about who might live in the house, it's about how we got there. And so I think for me, the message to our elected officials is all around local control. So I agree with that comment. I guess I'm thinking about, you know, in my day job in healthcare, everyone that has an appendicitis doesn't get the same appendix. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all that this legislation is written so blanketly, that isn't a word. But I'll just say it again. It's not the same. And so the inability of our legislature to distinguish that this is different than that is sort of beyond my comprehension. So I think that's really the message that, for me, that we need to communicate thoughtfully and calmly. But it's about the kind of place we want to create. We've done a really good job. We can do better. We will do better. But that, to me, is the single biggest driver that we still remain in control of the kind of place we want to live. Because I do think at this pace in 10 years, local government will have a very little, small role to play in any of this work. So I would support the staff recommendation and the support and oppose on those pieces of legislation, and I would hope that we would do that and then find additional ways for advocacy as citizens and as individual citizens sitting up here. Same voice, I think, would be important.
What we heard Andy say tonight is that we're in compliance with all the state regulations, and the state has told us so. The governor even told us so. And this is the best graphic you had. You know what this means? No good deed goes unpunished. Because we've, in the past, as Lynn and Bob have said, leaders that came before us have done a great job in making sure that we're this quality community. But it's our flavor. It is a welcoming community. My parents came here with nothing in the 50s, and by the time it was their time to depart this earth, they had found prosperity for themselves and their children. That could only be said about one, America, but two, about Clovis. And so that's all we're asking for, is that we want our own flavor of how to get to these numbers, and we are a very welcoming community. We were welcoming when Dust Bowl happened. We were welcoming in the 50s. We were welcoming in the 80s. And we continue to be welcoming. And this council, if you look at us, reflects that. So I also support the recommendations of staff.
Yeah, Bob, thank you for, you know, I think that context was very important. And, you know, many times we forget that it is us who makes Clovis, and not the house, not the street, you know, not the business. It's the people who makes Clovis. And because of that, sometimes this type of house will come in, not by our choice, but we will have to also support it. And then we have to trust that we can influence those who want to live the Clovis way. But if we look, and the term affordable scares us, the term multifamily scares us, because we associate that with people who we think we can't influence or who think will change us, then I think we have to reflect upon ourselves. I believe that many of us who were poor, who moved into Clovis, wanted to see how Clovis did it better, how Clovis lived better, how Clovis taught their kids better. And we will have to always welcome those who are less fortunate into our neighborhoods. And when we do, we have to say that at the beginning it seems scary because they live in an apartment, but I guarantee you, that kid and my kid, when they become friends, I care less what they drive, I care less where they eat from, I care less if they're getting a welfare check or if they're working, laboring in the fields. It's just, you know, they get along. And I think we can't forget that. These are coming down, and we just have to say, how do we play? Who do we play with, and how do we make it where it can work here in Clovis? I think with regards to what we're putting out, sometimes the misconception comes because I think we haven't allowed, with regards to what we're doing, I think we need to allow both sides to influence us. Tonight, I think we heard, but we heard it from one view. So there are those who are for these ABSB, whatever. Let's hear from them and say, this is why we're pushing it, council. Now you can make a decision. Because tonight, I haven't even read these, so I don't know. I don't know if AB 1763, I should oppose it, or I should be for it. Okay, and so that's why I want the process to be much more clear. And tonight, even if you're the member of a public, you don't even know that you're coming here to see if your council will support any of these or oppose any of these, because it was just educational, I felt. Let's allow the opportunity for the discussion to happen. And in the end, we may end up exactly where we're at. But I think the perception then gets broken down because we allow the dialogue to happen, and we as a council allow the discussion to happen, whether it's that's done on staff level and then brought back to us or done here openly in the public. Because I feel like those who are for or against these are afraid to discuss, first of all, because they didn't know it was going to be these items. Second, we need to invite, if we call them the enemy, we need to invite the enemy to face us and say, this is why you should do it, Clovis, this is why you should support it. And then that will allow us to go, okay, I haven't heard that argument before, I haven't heard that. And in the end, we can kind of still kind of say, we don't agree with you at all. That's how I would like us to proceed. And so that's why even with, if we put this out and we have our voice over, someone who is on the other side will just say, there goes Clovis again. You see, because they won't look at local control. All they see is affordable housing, and they go, there goes Clovis opposing affordable housing again. But I think if we allow the dialogue, then we go, no, we heard it. Proponents of affordable housing came in, tried to, but we as a council decided that this was more important. That's just my opinion with regards to what's before us. That's why I feel like I'm not ready, even though I may end up at the same spot. I'm not ready to vote or to make a direction for the staff to support one way or the other because of that. And so, but excellent presentation. That's where I'm at. Thanks.
Thank you, Ron. I agree with my colleagues on the local control issue. This is not a one-size-fits-all thing for everybody. I think all of us have a story, and I think everybody in the audience probably has a story that, you know, I was on food stamps and on a VA pension, and when my dad died, all we had was Social Security, and I could very easily have been in an apartment in subsidized housing. I joined the Army so that I could pay for my college. So I think we've all been behind the eight ball, and I think as a community, we need to, as we've gone up the ladder, we need to reach down and pull the next people up. So we have a responsibility to be good neighbors and good stewards of the city's money and the taxpayers' money, but we also need to be kind to others, but we need to have control. Because then we don't want to be dictated to by someone who doesn't have our values or someone who doesn't have, they haven't really suffered, and they just want to make sure that we want to have affordable housing, but not in my neighborhood. So we just need to be able to do this properly and thoughtfully. So I agree with my colleagues. I think at this point we need to push back on local control, but also be open to the fact that we have to we need to build some affordable housing. What's our next step here?
Well, I'll go ahead and make a motion so that we can at least have a vote on the issue. And I want you to know, Vong, I appreciate your comments. I always do. I think that these recommendations are consistent with a position that we have talked about here, which is that regardless of how some people may feel either for or against a particular assembly bill or Senate bill, what of these 2,000 or so which are percolating, we probably ought to communicate that we are for local control. And the position that we take on these bills will communicate that. And I'm hoping that that will be the message that's received. I can't control. I mean, some people are always going to maybe take, I shouldn't say always, but people can take things the wrong way. But we're going to be talking about how we think it's important for us in the city of Clovis to have local control over these planning issues. So in light of that, I'm moving that from a policy direction perspective that we endorse and support the recommendations made by staff on those particular bills that are in front of us.
I'd like to second, and I'd like to ask the motion maker, are these with opposed with amendment, unless amended, or are just plain opposed? Because what we do at the League of Cities is we always say we oppose a bill unless you amend it to accommodate our you know, values. And our value that we hold true and we hold very dear is that local control, because we want we might want 90% of what they're telling us to do, but that local control issue is very important for us. Give us some say-so. Don't just be dictators up in Sacramento and take that away. So as local governments, I think that's our duty. I mean, we're probably the closest thing the citizenry has to being able to see somebody at a Cougars fundraiser, you know, so than anybody else. Not like we said earlier, our state legislators are hardly in the valley, and our federal legislators even worse. So what if?
So if I can engage with you a little bit here. So I am of the opinion that on SB 50, based on the staff report at least, SB 50 is opposed unless amended. And the reason why the league has taken that particular position is that we want to be involved in the discussions related to SB 50. And if we take an oppose unless amended position, we feel that we might have a place at the table.
Yeah.
So that's a League of California Cities position. And I, the way I am reading staff's recommendation is that this is a clear support of AB 10 and SB 5 and a clear opposition of AB 1763. SB 48, SB 50, and SB 330. That would be my motion, and I would think that related to the issue of being involved in discussions with the authors, that we can engage through our league representatives who also have been trumpeting the local control position that the city of Clovis takes. But I'm open to hear from you. Are you suggesting that perhaps maybe we should do an oppose unless amended on SB 50 like the league has done?
Not every legislation. Just trying to think, are always evil, like Long said. They may have some good points, but we need a seat at the table. To just oppose it is also not, to simply oppose it is simply wrong. So I like the position usually the league takes, is that opposed unless amended.
So if memory serves, AB 1763 and SB 50, the league has recommended an opposed unless amended. There's been no position on SB 48, and SB 330 was a flat opposed.
So if you're suggesting that we should take the same positions at the League of California
Cities, I would.
Okay. All right, I'll go ahead and I'll make that modification to the motion, that we would be taking the same positions as the League of California Cities, with the exception of SB 48, which the league has not taken a position on, and on that,
that's correct.
And on that one, we would be opposed.
Second.
All right.
Good discussion.
Go ahead.
The reason I oppose it is just procedural. You know, many times when we support the police or fire, we write, it's always noticed. And when you read our notice tonight, it's just housing legislative update, consider policy direction regarding proposed legislation. We didn't receive the staff report, so there's no time for me as a council member and or the public to actually review back and forth pros and cons. So we get a presentation, and then now we take a position. And I think that's not good governance. Even if we will end there, now if there's a pressing where next week we got to make a decision, then let's you know, do it on the fly. So that's why I think we have to be fair in our notice. We have to be fair in what you present to the council, so that way I can go, oh, this is this. That way I can go look and say, hey, you know, you're in housing. What is the gist of this? How can you help me? So that's my only opposition to it, because I think the public needed to see what was going to be decided upon in our policy direction this evening, and also me as a council member. So.
Can I ask our city attorney, was it noticed properly to have a action item on it?
I'm just checking the agenda right now. I believe it was. Just trying to. Yes, consider policy direction regarding proposed legislation. So from the Brown Act standpoint, yes, but I know Councilmember Wanda, too, is making a different point there.
So the answer is yes or maybe.
So, Vong, how much time would you be comfortable with if we were to continue the vote on the policy direction? How much time would you recommend?
I think if we're going to take these positions and we noticed it as such, mm-hmm. because usually we notice we're going to support, you know, write a letter in opposition. Mm-hmm. And so that way the public knows that tonight our council is going to take these positions policy-wise. So whether it's next week, I'm fine with it, but I think we need to do that, because if we do it on a blanket like this, tonight we could have made any policy decision regarding housing, and the public would not have been aware. So, for example, we could just tonight could have said, our policy is no affordable housing. And how would they have known we were going to decide that tonight? Or we're saying affordable housing to the max. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the way I see it.
And then, Andy, if I can ask you, you know, the legislative process is moving right now. I don't know, though, that, you know, postponing 1 week is going to make that big of a difference on communicating our position on these particular bills. Do you have a different view than that?
Not that I'm aware of. It would be no significant difference in 1 week.
Okay. I think just to accommodate some of the concerns mentioned by our colleague, that it makes sense for us just to continue the matter for a week. Andy, if you wouldn't mind just agendizing, I'm sorry, talking like I'm mayor again. Sorry. So if I would, what I will do, and I'm willing to do this, is continue my motion for 1 week. So the motion has been made and it has been seconded, and then we will vote on it next week after we have additional public hearing on those bills.
So on my other hat, on my job, I'll be pursuing retailers at a trade show next Monday. Out of town. If you'd like me to be at the meeting, it would need to be continued to the meeting in June. If not, I'm sure other staff could handle it.
Well, we're starting to run up on some deadlines when we start heading towards June.
We have Dwight.
Yeah. So I want you to know you've done a great job with your presentation, but I think that we can probably just decide next week without you, and that you know, Dwight just bone up on any issues related to the legislation in case we have some questions that we haven't answered ourselves. All right. So I'm going to make a motion on top of my motion, which is to continue my motion until next week.
I'll second that to be consistent.
So you second that motion?
Yes. Sorry, not
that motion. Okay. Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? No. Okay. We have 5-0 passed. Okay. We are at, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming tonight, by the way. It's nice to see so many people here care about the community. We're at city manager's comments. Luke?
I've got nothing tonight.
Okay. Council items. Consider approval of various city council committee appointments. Staff is Luke Serpa.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So this is the opportunity when we reorg council after every 2 years after the election, that we certain seats need to be reassigned on various committee and assignments and organization assignments.